Hello everyone, my name is Phil Blancato. I am CEO and President of Latimer Thalmann Asset Management, a division of Advisor Group. Today is already May the 6th. Can you believe we're already 5 months into the year? My gosh, how time flies. Well, welcome to another update call. We're going to talk a bit about the economy, the virus, its impact, and expectations as we go forward. As of this call, there are 3.8 million people globally impacted by the virus. Of those, 1.2 million have recovered, and unfortunately, 264,000 tragic deaths. Of the active cases, which are 2.2 million, 2.211 are actually in a mild condition, and 48,000 are in a serious condition. Keep that number. 48,000 global cases are serious, or roughly 2% of the active cases are in a serious condition. Keep that number in mind for a moment. Of the closed cases, 83% recovered, 1.28 million, and again, 264,000 have resulted in death. On a global basis, we're seeing the curve flattening and beginning to actually bend globally. There are still some hotspots like Brazil and Canada, but by and large, the numbers have improved quite a bit. In the United States, 1.256 million cases, 74,000 tragic deaths, 200,000 recovered. And again, of our active cases, only a small amount are now serious condition. When we think about the severity of the people who are sick, it's critical that we use examples of where we think we might be going from an overall impact. You see, the strength of the U.S. hospital system is a critical component of this. When you look at the folks that have passed away in Europe versus the folks that have passed away in the United States, believe it or not, we have less people have been impacted, but only about a third of the deaths compared to Europe. So kudos to the American healthcare system. But when we focus on New York City, the people that have passed away in New York are a critical way to analyze the total amount of how this is all resulting out. And in fact, when we go and look really at the hard data, it comes down to the people that have passed away as of May the 4th. 75% of the 13,000 that have passed away in greater New York area had a underlying condition. Believe it or not, of the 13,724 people that have passed away, only 84 had no underlying condition. Now, there's about 3,000 people that we don't know whether they had one or did not have one. But if we apply the same ratio of the people who did have a condition versus those who did not, it comes up to roughly 99% of the people had a pre-existing condition or were elderly. It's an important component as we start to think about how we're going to open up the U.S. economy and the impact from it. Furthermore, I live in New Jersey and I work in New York City. I am in probably the hottest spot in the country. Well, not probably, for sure. 60% of the cases are in this area. But recently there was a survey done, and that survey came out and said that of the 15,000 people that were tested in New York City, believe it or not, 20% of them already showed antibodies. One in five people in New York have the virus or had the virus to some degree. Remember, 85% of the people who get this virus don't even know they had it, don't even get tested for it because for them it's just a bad cold, or in some cases, not even that. When you expand it out to the state of New York, it actually works out to one in seven have had it. Really pretty fascinating. So this is a critical component. When we think about the percentage of people who are dying versus those who have been infected, the rate of fatality is right around 7%. But then if you take all the unknown people and add them back to that equation, it actually drops to half of 1%. So the fatality rate is significantly lower. And in fact, when you think about the overall global approach to it, how we open up the economy gives us a clear path. Because of the two unknowns that we need to know about the marketplace. First, who has it and who's being most impacted by it? How quickly is it spreading? And then second, what can we do about it? What vaccinations or antibodies can we use? And what processes can we put in place called non-pharmaceutical interventions or NPIs, which are up to a degree the physical distancing we're going through, plus wearing a mask, plus washing your hands, and plus being very careful to not touch your face. Those two things combined will help. Those things combined will help us with the second unknown of how we shut this thing down. But the first part we know about, and when you do the total math, it tells us where we need to focus our energy. It's a critical component to this. So as we go through and think about the spread of the virus, the next step is, well, how do we test people accurately to be able to understand whether or not they show antibodies in their system? Well, as of right now, there are 12 approved FDA test kits out there. The best one right now is Roche. And from a sensitivity and a specificity standpoint, meaning how good is it getting the test and how accurate is the test, Roche has one that's 100% for sensitivity and 99.8% for specificity. But every one of these tests is extremely high rankings. Remember, in the past, we've talked about Abbott Laboratories, which actually has a test called the Pixel you can do at home yourself at some point very soon. It's 100% sensitivity and 99.6% on specificity. That's a tough word for me for some reason today. More importantly, I just got an email from my doctor today that said if I would like a take-home antibody test, they can mail me one in the mail and I can turn around and have a result in 3 to 5 days. My local city MD, just near my house, is offering tests in there, and depending on your insurance, costs anywhere from $0 to $50 to be able to get tests. The point being that we need to test up to 5 million people per week. There's a belief we can do 5 million people per day. But the reason why the testing is so critical is that as we go down the path of reopening the economy, you're going to have to know, one, who has it so we stop the spread, but more importantly, how do we protect the most vulnerable? And the most vulnerable are the folks that have a pre-existing condition like a liver disease or cancer or heart disease or lung disease, those who are elderly, and how do we make that a focal point for us to limit the spread and, more importantly, the fatality rate? And that process is really taking hold when you think about what businesses are morphing into. Over the next month, you're going to hear numerous stories about how different companies are having different approaches to be able to open up an office tower. As in an office where I'm at today with roughly 100 people, there's only 3 of us here on a daily basis. So I'm one of them. I can be more efficient here in New York, but my entire staff is somewhere else. A good example of what's happening is PricewaterhouseCoopers, believe it or not, is having to launch their own phone app. And that app is going to be able to trace where the folks have been, who they've been in contact with, and are they doing a good job of social distancing. You're going to hear stories about how office towers are now going to have heat sensors in them. They're going to be protocols about how you go about your daily life, how you social distance in your office, with the key being having a 6-step process in place to be able to reopen. And those 6 steps are, who do we need to protect? What industries can we open up? What process do we have around social distancing? What vaccinations or medical protocols do we have in place? Then what non-essential businesses can we open up? And then to what degree can we do that? So all these come together to create a plan. And that idea of surveillance tools to be able to open up the economy is an extremely hot topic right now, from the idea of being, how do we open up? Another good example in Northern California, a little town called Bolinas, is actually testing every single person in the town. And what they've come to find out that as of right now, they have basically a very low infectious rate. The Mission District in San Francisco, very near, very close to Bolinas, is going about and they're finding out they only have a 2% infection rate. Now that sounds very low considering we know New York City has such a high rate. Well, obviously we had a greater impact in New York because of our density. But in that scenario, since they know that for both of those little areas, they don't have a lot of people infected, then they can focus their efforts on the people who are most susceptible and let the other folks get back to work. Because whether you're young below the age of 18, believe it or not, the infectious rate under the age of 18 is less than 1% in most cases. Of 150,000 people who had the virus, less than 1% were below the age of 18, so a very powerful component to it. And then the idea of looking at the process by opening it is this distancing approach that we have to be smart about, because there are profound economic impacts that are coming by using a broad brush to shutting the economy. I'll use an example of schools. If you think about the impact on schools, while most kids are completely unsusceptible to this, very, very low percentile. If you look at New York City, there's no one that has been impacted by the disease under the age of 18. This data is available on the New York City website. And you'll find that, yet we're shutting all the schools down. But here's the problem. The U.S. economy could lose up to $1 trillion in total revenue by having schools closed everywhere. Our collegiate educational system is one of the most lucrative businesses we have.
But just below the level of 18, think of the teachers that aren't teaching, the administrators, the janitors, the schools, the energy not being used, but more importantly, the parents that have to stay home because their children are home. And yet in this scenario, there could be a very smart way to open up schools because the children are not susceptible, but obviously we have to be careful about teachers. Think about elective surgeries that are not happening and the revenue that's taking out of the hospital sitting, putting immense pressure on the hospital system. So these are areas of the economy that could open up carefully with mitigation measures, being mindful that there's tools in the toolkit that allow us to do that to begin to generate revenue. And in fact, as we go through this, we are the beginnings of revenue generation is going to have to happen. Otherwise, the problem of the economic side could become so systemic, we may not find our way out of this. I'll give you a fun example. The usage of gasoline over the last 3 weeks is up about 26%. That's exciting news. We're seeing hotel stays up about 15 to 16%. We're actually seeing energy usage go up a bit. As states open up, we're seeing people begin to look to begin to travel a bit more, use a little bit more gasoline. I actually have a friend down in Louisiana, Pierre Adams, a buddy of mine, who paid $1.40 for gasoline over the weekend. That's a stimulant for the consumer, and we're actually starting to see people use that. So gasoline, hotel stays, electrical demand, and then a really interesting one, on your phone, your map search. You go on the maps and look for everything. Map searches are up. Up quite a bit over the last week. So people are again beginning to venture out. Now, can we do this in a manner that allows us to keep the social distancing in place to be able to prevent it? Well, that's where it comes into this idea of what NPIs are out there, whether it's washing your hands, wearing a mask, staying distant, opening a business in a methodical way. And we think about it, what states are going down that process. As of right now, we're seeing over 24 states that are going to be partially open, and another 4 to be added this Friday, and a continuum from there. But to a degree, understand there is a methodical way to this. Florida, which has been very effective at managing the virus with their emphasis on older folks, believe it or not, it's only going to open up restaurants for outside dining to 25% of capacity. Same thing for Texas, Indiana, and Nebraska. Nebraska is going to allow worship again, folks to go into their religious houses, but must be 6 feet apart. So there is a process we can go through here that would allow us to open up the economy, not return to full speed. I think that's a bit of a misnomer that we can turn it back on and have some golden lever to ramp us back up here. That's not really the case, but it is the case that we'll begin to generate economic activity to take some of the pressure off the financing that the federal government has come to do. Federal government at this point has plans to issue as much as $11.8 trillion in total debt. That is an incredible amount of money. For the first time since World War II, our debt-to-GDP ratio, the amount of money we make versus the amount we owe, could exceed 100%, meaning we'll owe more than what we make. We haven't spent the entire $11 trillion yet, but we're beginning to spend it. We've spent a few trillion so far. You know about the rescue program out there for folks who have lost their job, for small businesses. A second round of financing went out for small businesses, an additional $484 billion, which is a great thing to buy us this bridge to the other side of the virus, assuming there is one, that we will be in a situation where we'll have enough liquidity in the system to create economic growth once we begin the process of opening up. But kudos to the United States for spending this much money. Now, I know many of you are concerned about ballooning the deficit, but did you know in a few days here, for the first time in 30 years, we're going to issue 20-year Treasury bonds at a rate that's very low. Just imagine for you if you went out to buy a new car or a new house and you have a certain amount of money you could spend, but your finance cost is a fraction of what you thought it might be. It gives you more dollars to spend. That's where the United States is today, that we're able to use this money because the financing is very low and we're still the strongest economy in the world. There are people who want our debt, countries who want our debt. Compared to the rest of the world, they're basically spending, in most cases, less than half of what we're spending. Europe is only going to spend $2.7 trillion. We're going to spend more than four times that amount. So I know that might be a bit of a concern, but as for now, to keep the economy running, to keep people healthy, to keep them indoors when they have to be, and then more importantly, provide us with the liquidity to get the economy growing again is a very important part about this. Now, I know some of you have been asking, why are we so such a rush to get the economy going? Well, certainly you know the economic impact, and we'll get to that in just a second.
And as I mentioned, we're starting to see a little bit of peaks of sunshine from overall economic data. And I'll get to economic data more in a second. But I do think it's very relevant to note when you look at the data around the curve itself. And this is very important from the idea that where are we going? On a 7-day moving average, the entire European continent will go to negative rates of infection. That means more people will get better than are getting sick. And in fact, if you look at places like for example, Italy for a minute, the active cases in Italy goes to negative 2,000 by next week, meaning there'll be more people getting better, less people getting affected. So their overall active cases continue to shrink significantly by up to maybe 1,000 or 2,000 a day. The United States is projected to be on that trajectory where the number, remember that million people I talked about before, will begin to shrink, not grow, by May 15th. And that's why so many areas are beginning to get very excited about opening up, because whether it's Germany or it's Spain, across the board, the change in active cases is pretty significant now that we're seeing the number of hospitalizations, the number of people getting sick, be less than lesser and less, and that's causing the total number of cases to go down. And that curve is important, and that's why everyone is opening up here and we're beginning that process. More so in Europe, because they're about 2 weeks ahead of us, but we are close behind them as we're seeing our total numbers come back down. And it is that change in confirmed cases, where, as I mentioned already, the number of going negative or going to small single digits is why we're able to open up. Where, in fact, if you think about a South Korea, where they've had a 98% success rate in reducing the number of people who have been infected by it. The decline from the peak is 98%, and their daily decline is over 11%. So they have made a huge impact on it. And in fact, when you look comparatively to the United States on the trajectory we're on, believe it or not, by the end of May, we could have a situation where we are below 1,000 new cases per day on the current projections, which is really very powerful, that we've gone from 30,000 to maybe, it's, I would argue, probably between 1,000 to 5,000, but some projections as low as 5,000. So the data behind this supports it very much as to why we're beginning to open up. But the key is, can we open up in a way that then doesn't spike it back up? And that's where that social distancing matters so much. Now, the University of Washington, which has been a source of getting a feel for how many people are infected on a projection basis and death, has changed their numbers significantly. They had initially hundreds of thousands of people passing away from it. Then they reduced it radically down to only 60,000. As you know, we're just about there now in the United States. In fact, when you think about the United States as of right now, we are, you know, in a kind of a unique scenario in that we're in an ebb tide, but hopefully about to get a lot better. But latest projections for the United States have actually ticked up. The University of Washington had first ratcheted down to 60%, and now it's ratcheted up to around, depending on their latest numbers, around 150,000 fatalities by the end of August. So that's a very significant number that they had come down quite a bit when the social distancing was really in full force. Now that we've begun to open up a bit, they've got concerns and restated their models that the numbers are actually going to increase a bit. Okay, I think that's fair. I think that is a possibility. But then comes the narrative of what's the rate of fatality that we're willing to accept with opening up the economy? Because I mentioned earlier, the economic impact is really quite profound. And at that, what balance do we need to strike between the two? Well, when you think about the American ingenuity and you think about what's going on here, if we know the spread and we can monitor it, that's that first unknown. The second unknown is, what can we do to be able to manage this process as we go forward? And clearly, that's the movement on the vaccine front. And the latest movement on the vaccine front is looking at the three components of it. First, it's testing, which I've mentioned already to a degree. Second is going to be what antiviruses are out there. And an antivirus or an antibody is critical in all this, because a vaccine, while still a bit far away, an antivirus can really be pretty profound in that it can make a significant difference. Now, remember before I talked about, remember that number of 48,000 seriously affected. The news from Gilead, as I briefly mentioned last week, is pretty exciting in that we can take the number of days somebody's in the hospital down from 15 to maybe as little as 5, but probably on average closer to 10, and its impact is on 50% of the people. All right, so let's assume that 50% of that 48,000 I mentioned earlier can now reduce their hospital stay and not pass away, we've now taken the pressure off the hospital system, and we've got a prophylactic that can help people get better. That's why the Gilead news was such a big deal. But the latest movement is Regeneron's antibodies, which are coming to market here in late May and early June, could become a cocktail of sorts where they mix remdesivir from Gilead with Regeneron. With Regeneron's antibodies together, that's a two-fold punch. That one helps your lungs get better, and the other one acts as a prophylactic, preventing you from getting it and getting you significantly better faster. There are, believe it or not, at this point, and I'm just mentioning a few, 197 different therapies, 111 different vaccines. That's incredible when you think about the idea of, you know, where we're actually going from this race and whether medicine can happen. I personally gave blood yesterday, and while I was there, I saw a host of folks going in for a plasma donation, people who had the virus and they're willing to use their plasma to help people get better. And we're seeing success rates with plasma donation as well. There's a number of different drivers here. Mesoblast is something we're employing in New York City, where it's another process that is another repurposing of an existing drug to be able to help folks get better. And we've just begun this trial last week, so by next week at Mount Sinai, we'll have a very good idea if this drug called Remestel L can actually help bring the pressure off lungs. The whole core of this is, can we keep the hospital system in check without creating severe anxiety as far as the number of cases are there? I read a piece yesterday that said cancer patients are skipping their cancer treatments. Those going in for checkups are not simply going down, in some cases, as much as 95%. We can't have this virus lead to other tragic diseases that could cause a tick up in folks dying because of it. So certainly that's a concern. So on the antivirus front, there's a lot of really exciting things happening, and I mentioned just a few here, but I think there's more to come. On the vaccine front, even more exciting. One of the first companies I've mentioned to you a few weeks back, Moderna, is now in phase 2 trials. That's really a big deal, from the idea that an existing American-based company, who has a footprint overseas as well, is not only on the process in phase 2, but is so convinced that their vaccine will work, they're going to have 1 billion doses in production this year. They've teamed up with a company called Lonza to significantly increase their number of doses and begin so, believe it or not, in July. I find it hard to believe that Moderna wouldn't be creating these millions of vials of it if they didn't have a real opportunity for it. Another one. What's going on with Oxford University? AstraZeneca and an antivirus created by Oxford University has teamed up to create 100 million doses by the end. Excuse me, it's a vaccine, not an antivirus. 100 million doses by the end of the year for their particular vaccine. So far, testing results have been exceptional for this. They're testing it in the United States and are already inoculating thousands of people, up to as many as 5,000 people here in the next month, maybe as much as 6,000 people to find out if the drug is effective. There are four companies which are in phase 2 in China: CanSino, Sinopharm, and Beijing-based Sinovac. Sinopharm actually has two, excuse me, so three companies, one with two. All of them in phase 2, all of them in great production of it, and all of them making great strides. In fact, Sinovac came to market with an H1N1 swine flu vaccine as well. And then the latest one, which is really very exciting, is Pfizer is very much in the middle of this race. And Pfizer teamed up with a company called BioNTech. What Pfizer is saying is that they will have millions of doses of their vaccine by September and hundreds of millions of doses by early next year. They are that convinced that their vaccine is going to work. I find it hard to believe that we're going to have this many opportunities to work on this virus and not get profound success from one of them. So that second component is critical here, to be able to realize that there is an opportunity to make things better. And I think it's kind of amazing to talk about American ingenuity, whether it's True Value Hardware that's now producing hundreds of different types of bacterial sprays and hand sanitizers in their paint facility, General Motors making ventilators, and so on. The idea of animal spirits in parts of our economy are really very exciting, that our biggest companies are willing to come to the front line and help out. So far, we have an idea of the virus and its spread. We've got an idea of what we can do from a medical front. But now let's transition to economics. And the economics, to be quite honest with you, are not great. You're going to hear an unemployment number come out on Friday of one of the worst you've ever seen in your lifetime, if not the worst as of right now. 16% unemployment. There are 30 million people that have applied for unemployment. 22 million net people have lost their jobs. That's a massive amount of people. We're looking at 1/4 of corporate revenue being slashed, meaning that means on average, 1/4 of companies in the S&P 500 have lost, are going to lose revenue in the second quarter, and on an annualized basis, as much as 10% to 15% for the year. Those are massive corrections in corporate revenue. The drop in consumers' consumption is down nearly 8%. First quarter GDP was negative 5%. Second quarter GDP could be as bad as negative 35%. Really catastrophic numbers when you think about where we are from an economic standpoint. Numbers unlike that we've seen ever. It's beginning to look a bit like the Great Depression, when I say ever in this lifetime. When you think about the Great Depression era statistics, they are beginning to look a bit like this, except this one is so far much more short-lived. Remember, we squarely believe this is an event-driven recession. This was forced upon us. And for that reason, we are optimistic about that this won't last long because of the money that's being injected into the system and the strength of the consumer going into this, as well as corporate health going into this, and then not to mention the overall idea that the vaccines should come to market at a pace we've never quite seen before. But from an investment implication standpoint, yes, the data is terrible. Whether you're looking at consumer sentiment, which has fallen off very lofty highs into numbers that are very benign and on its way to some of the lowest numbers we've ever seen. What we focus on a lot is how are we doing from a manufacturing and a non-manufacturing standpoint. We measure those. And manufacturing was basically even on the year, not in contraction mode, not expansion mode, and it has fallen significantly, now in severe contraction mode. But the more important one, ISM non-manufacturing, the amount of stuff you buy and do beside things we make, you know, so the service industry is in significant contraction as of late as well. We're looking at corporate just pure earnings on a percentage basis being down 15% for the first quarter and as much as 35% for the second quarter. I'm throwing a lot of numbers at you. What all this means is the economy is shut down and not making any money right now. The beginning process of opening up is happening. Believe it or not, at TSA checkpoints, we've seen an increase over the last week of people flying. We are actually starting to see people get on planes again. Still down 90% year over year, but up about 5% from the prior week. So that's a positive sign. When you think about investment implications and what it means, well, first off, from a 10,000 foot level, let's remember and use history as our guide for a minute. If during the 2007-2008 recession, you never left the equity market and stayed invested, from before the recession beginning in 2008 through the end of March, believe it or not, your total return would have been 448% on a cumulative basis. If you invested at the very end of the recession and then began and kept your money in since then, your return would have only been 291%. So what my point is, you need to be invested for the long term. It's really difficult to be able to time the market precisely. So even if you came in at the lowest of lows or trying to time it out over the long term, you're still better off keeping your money invested, still better off keeping track from having it in the markets and accepting some of the volatilities. Not to say you can't make changes to better prepare yourself for the next recession, but certainly on the idea that you can, without a doubt, be invested smartly. And I think that's critical. And by smartly, I mean, right now, when you look at the S&P 500, it's not inexpensive. It's actually fairly expensive. And by that, I mean stocks have come a bit too far too fast. Even the bond market is very expensive. That interest rates have fallen to some of the lows we've never seen before. So I think it is critical to be mindful that you should expect volatility. In this range of the markets where we're in, we've gotten through the shock and awe step one. We're in a sideways trading market in step two, and the market needs to find a bottom and start grinding higher in step three. And for us, we need to get another fairly significant sell-off to believe we're in for the bottom. But significant doesn't mean another 25%. It means something like along the tune of another 10% down. The market resets, stocks become fairly valued, and then we get an opportunity to grind higher as we go forward based on improving economic data, because as we begin to open up, and then more importantly, based on the fact that we are hopefully continuing to make real advances on the medical front. So the chances of a pullback are quite high based on the current valuations in the stock market. And then I think it should be important to know that volatility, pullbacks of 5 to 10% are going to be something we're going to get used to for a period of time, especially if a second wave begins to hit us as we open up or hits us in the fall and we're not yet there on an antivirus or potentially a vaccine. But let's not forget, I mean, when you think about the Spanish flu and what happened so long ago in 1918, 1919, 50 million people died. And what happened in the 20s? Well, we had the Roaring 20s. You know, so it's not uncommon for tragic events to spawn really powerful events. World War II, we had some of the worst unemployment numbers, some of the greatest debt ever after World War II. But you remember, we skyrocketed thereafter, going into the 50s. And there was a period of time we had great growth rates in the United States as we began to produce and manufacture post-World War II. So no doubt about it that I think there is opportunity to stay invested, but be smartly invested. We did have one of the best Aprils we've had since 1987. Really incredible numbers. The market bounced up quite high, 26% from the bottom. So far in May, we're trading a bit sideways in the equity market. And when you hear things like, you know, Amazon coming out and saying all the money they're going to generate from a revenue standpoint, from an earnings standpoint, they're going to have to spend on managing the COVID crisis. When you hear Apple come out and really put up a spectacular numbers, but then turn around and not give us guidance going forward. They actually don't have expectations for how much money they can earn on a go-forward basis. So that's really pretty significant. And as I mentioned, Friday, you're going to have some really terrible job numbers. You're going to hear numbers that just sound incredibly bad. So when you put it all together, as another week goes by, let's surmise this by saying, first, you have to be aware that we're making success, we're making strides on the medical front. There are real success stories happening, Gilead be one of them, but the continuing of companies going into phase two trials and beginning to inoculate people is extremely exciting. Second, the health of the U.S. economy and the health of the U.S. consumer going into this, we're in good shape. But even now, consumer confidence hasn't fallen completely apart. And we're actually seeing savings rates be up there around 7%, 9%. So that's a good number for us in that while consumers aren't spending, which isn't great, they have dry powder for when we get on the other side of this. Third, the Federal Reserve has come in and supported the U.S. economy by providing lots of money to whether it's municipalities, corporations, big and small, or the end consumer. And that's an opportunity to get us going on the other side. And then finally, when we combine it all together, we as a society, I think, are recognizing, and you see it from the data, that we need to be mindful of what's happening and protect ourselves using NPIs to wear a mask and wash our hands and not touch our face and be socially distant, because it is going to matter to limit the economic impact, which could be as bad as the viral impact. And that's a critical component in this whole process. I wrap up by saying, you know, I think the American innovation, the American success story, the animal spirits that are in our economy are beginning to percolate out. Let's hope we can do it in a smart and efficient manner. Let's hope that the economic data begins to mildly improve and continue to improve going into the summer. Let's hope that summer months, the heat and the temperature really bring down the virus, coupled with our ability to be smart about it and set us up for what should be an exciting fall. Because if we win on the medical front, then we win on all fronts. And that's an opportunity for us to get back to some level of normalcy, personally, professionally, for markets, for us, and more importantly, for so many people who have gotten sick by this. We hope this week was helpful for you. Remember, wash your hands. Don't touch your face. Enjoy the sunshine. And we'll talk to you again next week. Thank you very much and have a great day.